Circus, the bombing of homes, and the terrorization of safe people. However, we are in the Gaza Strip despite these massacres, these pains, and a large number of martyrs, and most recently last night in the Nusayrat camp. We honor God's rituals on this great and blessed day, and we rejoice and make our children happy on this day.
Just time enough for the final thoughts of Charles Kelly and Mick Napier on the few moments we have left on this show. And before we went to that series there, Charles, we talked about the perhaps perceived toothlessness of the United Nations. At the moment, there's currently a case that's been brought by Nicaragua along the same lines as the South African case, this time against Germany for what Nicaragua is arguing is facilitating the genocide by continuing to sell arms to Israel. Give me your thoughts on that. Will it go anyway differently to the ICJ case with South Africa that's currently being considered?
I think it's helpful in the sense that it brings attention to countries like Germany, and it's educational, but I can't see it going that far. I mean, there was a barrister talking about just things like, you know, it's ironic that Germany is dropping aid by planes into Gaza while at the same time supplying arms that is causing the problem. And it's a terrible situation. The people of Gaza, I saw footage of them celebrating Eid, and you've got to admire their faith to go out and still try and carry on with some sort of normality. But meanwhile, it's a very dark situation for them, and with, you know, Netanyahu promising to go into Rafah. I mean, why this guy is prime minister, I just don't know. His comeback from fraud charges to becoming prime minister again is on a par with the comeback of Lazarus, isn't it? Because what is he, the comeback kid or something? How he can be in power? And now, of course, he needs the war to stay in power. And it's a horrendous situation for the rest of the world, as well as Gaza.
Well, some people are hoping he'll be the Hague kid after this. Mick Napier, the idea here that, as I mentioned in the introduction, Netanyahu says no force in the world will stop this Rafah offensive. It's nonsensical, isn't it?
It's based on his always being able to publicly defy condemnation from the EU, from the UN, but condemnations that rested all at words. And he doesn't care if the whole world recognises that he's a criminal, and the whole Zionist elite has long been committed to ethnic cleansing and full-spectrum criminality, as long as there are no effective sanctions. They only respond to force. The problem with the UN is, of course, it's designed in such a way that America and Britain and others can paralyse any action against their interests. I mean, I would like to carry water in a bucket, but if there's a big hole in it, then it's not much use as a bucket. And the UN suffers from a structural weakness of the same kind. We are now at a situation where governments are embarrassed by Israel, but they continue to send bombs together with the criticism. They continue to send bombs and ask for a kinder, gentler genocide. But around the world, Europe is fantastically isolated. We see the Houthis in Yemen coming to the aid of the people of Gaza facing genocide, acting on international law, acting to do everything within their power to end that genocide, and being bombed by Britain and America. But here's the question. Why didn't the US carpet bomb Yemen as they carpet bombed Vietnam with B-52s? They could wipe out everybody because they're afraid. They realise that they're in a situation where if they inflame popular opinion throughout the region sufficiently, then they will be defeated. And I think that the resistance across the region, Yemen, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, everywhere, that's the key to victory. And that, backed up by an increasingly angry world public opinion, which can force a political price on our rulers, that's the key to victory. Otherwise, Israel will ultimately generate a huge regional war which will have cataclysmic suffering for all of us. It was built into the very DNA of the Zionist project to displace millions of local people to make way for European Zionists.
Indeed, and Charles, last thoughts to you here. We're seeing these weekly demonstrations, one coming up in London at the end of this week. Are they working? Are they changing hearts and minds? Less than a minute.
I think gradually they are. And I mean, Mick mentioned Zionism, and of course, Zionists are not confined to just Jewish people only. The culture of Zionism is embedded into the US culture, the education system, our culture, our Judeo-Christian culture, and Zionism is embedded into that. And, you know, it is starting to change the hearts and mind. And Mick also mentioned about the Arab nations. But of course, they're not united, are they? And they've got their own interest and their own leagues with the West and their own economic interest. And you could say that some of them just don't care about Palestinians at all. So there's not a united front against Israel. And indeed, the Arab nations do business with Israel as well. So that, I think that's why Israel can survive. But definitely that Israel is the main cause of instability in that region. And they're bringing us to the brink of world war with their actions, these crazy actions by psychopathic leaders.
Indeed, what a place to leave things on. And that does it for us. Charles Kelly and Mick Napier were our very special guests. And of course, our thanks to them and to you for being with us. Until next time, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be examining a very important question. That question is related to zakat, or the alms tax. And this is a question that a lot of people ask. The question is this. When we want to pay the alms tax, the zakat, of course, right now we're considering zakat and alms tax in a very general manner of charity. We're not specifically talking about the zakat, which is a specific type of charity and becomes obligatory in certain situations. So this is important to take into consideration before we begin examining this question. So the question again is, who are we supposed to pay our charity to, or who deserves to receive our charity and our alms tax? Let's examine this question by probing into the verses of the Holy Quran. Fortunately, this question has been addressed in the Holy Quran in some of its verses. And in one verse of the Holy Quran, we read the following. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Charities are only for the poor and the needy, and those employed to collect them, and those whose hearts are to be reconciled, and for the freedom of slaves and the debtors, and in the way of Allah and for the traveler. This is an ordinance from Allah, and Allah is all-wise, all-knowing. Right, so in this verse of the Holy Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he mentions a number of different groups of people who we can donate our charities to. Like, for example, it begins by mentioning the poor and the needy, obviously. And then the people who are employed to collect the alms tax. So like the tax collectors themselves, they can benefit from the charity and the alms tax that they're collecting under certain situations and certain conditions. Those whose hearts are to be reconciled. This mu'allifatul qulub. This is a reference to like people who might not be Muslim or might not be adhering to the same religious sect that we adhere to. They might not be Shia, they might belong to another Islamic sect. And by spending our, you know, the charity, the money that we want to donate to charity on them and helping them, we could perhaps attract them to Islam or attract them to the Shia faith. This is another way in which we can spend our charity. For the freedom of slaves, we can use it to free slaves. Obviously, this isn't exactly applicable in our time. The next group is debtors. People who are in debt, we want to repay their debt for them. We may use our charity to repay their debt for them. And in the way of Allah and for the traveler, people who are traveling, they might have, you know, their resources might have finished in their journey, and they might be requiring some you know, some additional assistance to get back to their homeland. We can use it. We can use our charity for them. In this connection, it's also been mentioned that Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam said, "The poor man is he who does not beg from people despite his poverty. The destitute lives in harsher conditions than him, and the wretched one lives in the most strained and straitened circumstances of them all." These are like different levels of poverty and poor people, you know, to whom we may distribute our charity to. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at people who we are supposed to pay our charities to in the light of the Quran and the Hadith. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers. In Islamic upbringing,
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids? That is, from the very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to IRIB English Radio, where we explore the Islamic upbringing of children and teenagers, guided by the wisdom of the Quran and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. Today, we are honored to have Sister Salma Khalfan, a distinguished Islamic researcher, with us to shed light on this important subject. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Salma. Thank you for joining us today.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me over.
Thank you so much for being here. So we have a question that we had been discussing in the past sessions, and it was about a 15-year-old daughter who doesn't talk about her problems to her mother. And the mother was concerned about how she should, you know, go about it. And you had given us very good tips, one of which was, you know, we have to try and be positive, we have to do active listening. Do you have anything more to say?
Yes, we talked about the fact that when a parent wants to talk to her teenage, a mother wants to talk to her teenage, she should capture a moment when the teenage feels like talking. Sometimes it so happens then that the mother wants to or the father wants to talk to them, but they're not in a mood of talking. So we should respect those moments of them, their privacies. True. Maybe they're so bottled up inside that they don't feel like, you know, relating and showing their weaknesses. Or maybe they feel like, you know, just talking to themselves, you can say, or just sleeping over it and forgetting a little about the pain. But then it happens so that they forget and they are easy a bit when time passes. And then when they so happen to want to talk about it, you know, because if they see that there is so much compassion at home, then they know that their parents relate to them, especially the mother. So she will, a teenage girl especially, would feel like talking, and she would then, you know, like ask the parent to listen to them. And therefore, this mother who wants to talk to her, whatever she be doing at that time, she should leave. Of course, apart from the other things that are so wajib, like prayer and everything. But of course, at that time, she should, you know, like capture that moment and...
I think it also helps remove the barrier, because sometimes those barriers are built between the parents and children, because the children, the teenagers feel like the parents just don't understand them.
Yes.
They don't respect their, you know, boundaries and etc. So,
and why do they think that their friends do? It's because their friends do active listening.
Mm.
They're so like, you know, eager, and they're so willing to listen.
True.
And they, you know, they share those sorrows with them also. So they know that there's a listening ear, and the best is the parent if she gives that listening ear. And mostly parents do that, but sometimes it happens so that the parents forget about this thing. They don't capture themselves as being young, you know, one day. One day all of us, the parents were also young, and they don't know how it feels to be in the skin of a young person.
Very true.
You know, they forget about it.
And I think sometimes parents resort to giving solutions straight away, or they judge them, or the teenagers feel judged, and
usually
from their friends,
absolutely,
they feel like, okay, now they understand.
Yes, they don't judge them, exactly. So this is one part of active listening.
Yeah.
And then we talked about positive, being positive. Always look at the bright side of things.
Yeah.
You know, like... if we are so much negative ourselves, then the child will take that negative energy and feel more sorrowful over what matter they are maybe, you know, like feeling sad over.
True.
So, however much at home we are supposed to be positive, to bring that positive nature about it, like, what a good day I had today, such and such good thing happened. Maybe, for example, we did a good thing in the morning, and then we, you know, we enjoyed our breakfast. When we went, we saw this and we admired the beauty of the nature, or whatever be it, you know, some things that need to be mostly pumped in, like to the youth, that to bring about that positive nature at home.
True.
It's very important.
I think the vibe is very important.
Yes, the vibe.
So we'll just take a quick break and pick up shortly.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. This is IRIB English Radio, and we have been discussing about one of the questions that had been previously asked about a mother worried about her 15-year-old daughter who doesn't talk about her problems to her mother anymore. And you gave some very informative lessons in how to deal with the teenagers. So did you want to expand on those?
Yes. Another way to open up a conversation with her teenage daughter is maybe focus on their interests. This is very important that, you know, when a person is interested in something and probably you are not, you shouldn't, you know, forego that as something that, or take it for granted.
Yeah.
For example, if your daughter is interested in craft work or maybe some creativity or artwork or cooking or, you know, anything, reading. So know that subject as, you know, take it seriously. I guess when a parent is really caring, it happens.
Yeah.
That when a parent is caring, they see even the boy's interest or the girl's interest and they search on that. And they want to see more on that, maybe documentaries or read about it. And then talk to them about it, yeah? So they know that this my parent is sharing my interests with me.
True.
So they have more to talk about. So what happens is that when they see that the small stuff is not taken for granted, you know, like small hobbies or things that they like or remembering their favorite color, remembering their favorite dish and things like that or what they like and discussing about it and giving a comment on that, that they know that, that the parents share their interests about the small stuff, so they will also resort to in the big matters.
I think many teenagers go through this, that you know, nobody understands me and nobody really cares for me, and however much you go and tell them no, we care, no,
yeah,
they have to see
that's not
action.
Enough, yeah.
Yeah, so when parents actually show interest in what they're doing, not just for the sake of it, no, actual interest, and teenagers are very smart, yeah, they know when the parents are just saying
yeah,
or actually
exactly, yeah,
feeling or doing something for yeah, the sake of that.
It's so nice that if a daughter is so much you know, like taken up with the interests of the parent, like sometimes, you know, in creativity, a mother likes to stitch, so the child even feels that, you know, urge to
yeah,
want to explore that field and stitch and everything. So both can discuss so well on that matter, or cooking or anything, reading, for instance, or, you know, like matters that are like political matters of the day-to-day time, and they can discuss on that too, or a subject for that matter, for example, English literature or literary subject like Nahjul Balagha,
yeah,
the eloquence of it, and, you know, parents, or Quran, for instance. Parents can discuss so much with the children, you know, that really gives a big you know, heart to the parents especially. But however, we say that if the child has different interests, probe on those interests and see what the goodness comes out of it. And maybe here and there you can comment on that, and you can ask them, have you discovered this part of your interest, you know,
yeah,
and this interest of yours has these kind of advantages, or what did you do about it, maybe have you done anything new, you know, like
exactly,
for example, art is concerned, it's a very good you know, like talent, but of course it has to be like taken seriously and discussed about and shown interest.
Very true, very true. So let's just have a short break and we will continue shortly.
Ya muqdi al-khayrat, ya muqdi al-khayrat, ya muqdi al-khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Ya muqdi al-khayrat, ya muqdi
al-khayrat. Welcome back, and we have been discussing about what to do to have a better relation with your teenage children especially, and Sister Salma has been telling us a lot about how to deal with that, you know, focus on their interests, show interest in their interests, and that will really build a bond.
Yeah,
so do you want to say more on that?
Yes, another thing that I want to point out is avoid talking too much. Although we just discussed about how there should be a verbal interaction between the parent and the child, the teenager, that, you know, you have to know about their interests and everything. But here, avoid talking too much in the other times.
Yeah.
For example, however much you speak to an adult who's your age or something, try to, you know, hear out more from your teenager.
True.
In fact, even from your children. Mm-hmm. They have so much to let out, their energy and everything. And then you should lend the listening ear. And especially, teenagers don't like you to advise them and to give a lecture, or, you know, like talking too much in the sense of giving them a lecture, or, you know, even telling them about your own things.
Yeah.
They like to be listened to. And in fact, this is a universal thing, yeah? If you go and see, mostly people, when they're listened to, actively, they really appreciate that more than when you give your opinions,
true,
right?
True.
Even a friend, even somebody who is a soulmate, your best friend,
your husband.
Yeah, they listen to you. You would appreciate them more. So avoid talking too much and, excessively also. And also questioning them. That why did you do this? Why don't you do this? Why did you, you made your own mistakes. So judging them.
Yeah.
They would repel from that. And they would feel that, just to turn a deaf ear on whatever we are saying.
True.
And they would not confide then. So to want to make a teenager talk to you is that try to talk less and listen more.
Okay? Showing that interest.
Yeah.
Showing that,
yes.
I'm here for you.
Yeah.
And giving that full attention.
And also that you are supposed to talk more than me.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then another thing is that admitting our mistakes. Sometimes when we make mistakes, we don't admit them, they pile up. When they pile up, the teenager feels that, my mother is always in cross with me.
Yeah.
And she's always at loggerheads with me. So I can't relate to her. But if you admit your mistakes, then they know even how to admit their mistakes.
True.
They know that it's nothing wrong to do that. And that's why we have rights of a child also. Rights of a, and especially when it comes to adult child, like for example a teenager, is now has the right mind to decide between right and wrong. So he sees or she sees what's going on, and they don't like some things. So we shouldn't say that it's a child, he's my child, I have authority over them.
Yeah.
Although you have guidance and you share more authority, but you have no right to, for example, tease them or pass a comment that makes them feel hurt. So you should, like, even if you, for example, sometimes, parents tend to joke about maybe the clothing style or the hairstyle. So the girl especially takes it very much at heart.
Yeah.
So this needs to be corrected before it's too late. So the parent should be sensitive enough to see what makes them feel bad, what makes them, comments that we talk to our friends about our girls when they are nearby.
Yeah.
So that we should be very careful and hypersensitive about it, that what makes our children feel bad, we should not, stake that with the relationship.
Yeah. I remember even when I was a child, if even though there was something very simple, very small, it wasn't even very important, but as soon as my parents would, joke about it, I would take it very much to heart. Like, I'd feel like they're disrespecting me.
Yeah.
When they had no intention whatsoever. And
yeah.
After that, I think because my mother made a bond with me, I was able to communicate that. And then she realized, okay, no, then we shouldn't bring these matters about. And alhamdulillah, that really put my self-esteem up, because otherwise it's very easy to get a low self-esteem from that young age if the parents, joke about them or tease their children too much, but with a good heart. But it has its, its stakes.
Yes,
as you said.
So last but not least, we should consider one point, and that's very important for all ages, not only teenagers, in fact for adults as well, is that you should remind them that you love them. And not just, just remember that I love you. No, it's concentrating on that, pointing out the qualities, what you like, what you appreciate. And also acknowledge the fact that, you receive that love from them. So it's not just one-sided, it should be two-sided. Acknowledge
True.
It, yeah?
Yeah.
That remind them that how important they are in your lives. Remind them all these things so that they can feel that, empowered. Because love is the only thing that really empowers a person.
True.
Yeah, they'll feel so much trust and satisfaction, and of course they'll have a better relationship with the parents as life goes on. Mostly, if you go and see when teenagers grow up to be adults, they say they were not close with their parents. And it's really a sad thing, yeah, to hear that a girl is not close to her parent. Why? It's because there was this communication gap between them. But the parent has to remind that, remember, you are very important for me. We think that it's just small children who need to be cuddled and loved and hugged, but it's also elder children.
Definitely.
They need to have that even probably more, because they shouldn't look for it outside. They know that they have a very strong relationship with their, at least one of their parents. They know that they confide. They know that they can even embrace them and hug them and, feel relaxed with them. So the parents should never refrain from that.
Very true, very true. So That was very, very insightful. And thank you very much for your valuable time, Sister Salma. And we hope to see you in the next episode. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening. You've just listened to IRIB English Radio, where we had a discussion on child upbringing. And if you want to listen to our programs or get more information, you can log on to parstoday.ir/en under the tab COI. Call of Islam, and if you type in Call of Islam Radio, you can find it on YouTube and Instagram, and you can email us on englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Citizens under surveillance.
To watch without being seen, that's the spirit of surveillance. It's always present in the citizens' lives, but in the past 10 years, along with the pace of technological advances, we have witnessed a revolution. Targeted surveillance has gradually turned into mass surveillance worldwide. In the past, it only focused on public areas, but now it's violating our privacy. Closing the door or drawing the curtains at home is not enough anymore. The invisible eye is settled in our privacy. Online items and games, activities on social networks, local details of our smartphones, and inquiries on the search engines. Our online life turns into data. The information that when processed makes a new form of identity on which we have no control. Our private life could be laid bare in a matter of moments. This is what we will watch in this preventive film. A few minutes would be enough for four hackers to tap into all this information. This experience is a warning. Our online life doesn't belong to us. Never have we been scrutinized so much. 70% of our calls by mobile phones are recorded. Millions of hours of discussion by webcam are diverted by the secret services. Our existence is now accessible on the internet in the form of databases, and every single detail of our lives is retained in the memories by the storage centers. Who records this valuable information? How is it exploited, and for what purposes? We have conducted a survey for 2 years in Europe and in the United States. We went to meet the experts in digital surveillance, hackers and whistleblowers, and also the web giants such as Google or Facebook, and also the secret services that process and collect our data. As the boundaries between surveillance, technology, and power fade, we will see that the gap is growing between two groups. On one side, defenders of individual freedoms, and on the other, supporters of cyber surveillance. A paradigm shift that can lead the citizens towards a new social model.
I think, you know, our modern societies are facing a choice about the future, and I think it's fundamentally a political choice. I think we could decide through an action to say, well, you know, we don't care very much about this. We don't care very much if the government gathers up all this information. We don't care very much about who has access to it, how it's used. We don't care if our children grow up in such a world of constant surveillance. And I think that could happen.
We abandon a part of our freedoms by accepting to be monitored in our private lives. In the field of surveillance, two viewpoints are nowadays coexisting and competing in the world. Some are rebelling against these violations of privacy in the name of individual freedom, while others consider technological developments as a preferred means of strengthening the security level. The United States, where the public domain may be monitored without any legal authorization, has developed an initiative for the pioneer collective surveillance, the NOLA Project. Citizens are at the heart of this community video surveillance project. The word security is increasingly associated with surveillance. We went to meet one of the world's leading researchers in this field. Sociologist David Lyon, a professor at the University of Kingston, leads the research laboratory of surveillance, where he has studied for 20 years the impacts of surveillance on our lifestyles.
There are questions about some balance or some tension between liberty on the one hand and privacy on the other, or security and liberty. There are various ways in which this debate is located. However, it seems to me that, again, the big questions still need to be asked.
And it was to protect our privacy that on September 5, 2001, only a few days before the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the European Union was going to adopt the historical sanctions against the United States in order to make it cease the large-scale spying on phone calls and fax messages, and especially to make it give up the establishment of email surveillance. Europe knew that since the Second World War, the NSA, along with the intelligence services of its Anglo-Saxon allies, monitored the old continent under a program called Echelon.
This new law that I signed today will allow surveillance of all communications used by terrorists, including emails, the internet, and cell phones. As of today, we'll be able to better meet the technological challenges posed by this proliferation of communications technology.
I don't think there's any effort or reasonable likelihood that the entire population of the United States could be controlled on pretty much anything. But in many cases, you do have to look at all of the information about the entire population in order to find people who are trying very hard to escape your notice, to try to hide from you. And often it is only when you look at the entire population that the people who are the riskiest, you don't know that they're guilty of anything, but you know that they are riskier than others, can get the attention that they deserve.
Tout est connecté. Feu de circulation. Caméra de surveillance.
Watchdogs is the playful extension of our hyper-connected society. A world in which everyone leaves behind them a thick cloud of clues, useful data, and potential incriminatory information. A world where all the connected objects are all spies, which record our slightest facts and gestures continuously.
Everything and everyone is connected. You can hack into anyone's life. Tap their phones, their music, their accounts. Identify criminals, disrupt communications, roadways, infiltrate private homes.
I suspect that players are gonna finish the game, pick up their phone, and immediately make that hard connection between our game world and the world outside. There's not a big line between the two. You know, we're heavily connected with the real world in ways we never expected. We never expected we'd be this.
I know the truth. I know how you think. I see the digital shadow you cast. You lie to everyone else. You can't hide from me.
But which part of our lives would be accessible in this way, unveiling our privacy and our conducts? Kenneth Cuckier, the data editor of The Economist and a former technology editor for the Wall Street Journal Asia, has investigated the traces that we leave in our online life. The facts foreshadow a new form of surveillance.
That information, which is far, far larger than it ever has been in the past, because we now have the mechanisms to collect it, store it, and process it, and there's an economic incentive to do so as well, because it's very valuable information, this huge data avatar that follows us around, sort of like a spirit of Greek mythology, together we're aware still of our physicality. We're still primed in that universe in our thinking. And because we don't see it, we don't understand that this great data penumbra behind us is much larger, much more valuable, and we can't protect it.
But how should we shape our digital shadow? No one can imagine what lies behind a simple internet connection. The Kukovits software, made available to the citizens by the CNIL, the French National Commission for Information Technology and Civil Liberties, allows us to spot the digital spies who come to be set on our IP address to spy on us. These little spies, known as cookies, provide the raw materials for statistics and analysis corporations. Within the first few minutes of our connection, for example, to an information site about trading, a myriad of cookies detect our presence and record our data. Each blue point is a private company that spies on our internet browsing. Our actions transform to some data are a gold mine for Facebook. This social network, on its website, Facebook for Business, which is destined for the companies, shows off its treasury of the personalized profiles that are its members. Find new customers, increase sales. What interests Facebook is this special profiling which is advertised by us, a perfectly targeted audience. More than a billion people are online through Facebook. An invisible monitoring which allows personalized advertising. For example, the category of wealthy, a prime target for certain advertisers, corresponds with 13% of the richest French people. Almost half of them are on Facebook. 3 million wealthy people on Facebook. Wealthy people use Facebook all day long. And the site, which scrutinizes their tastes and their everyday activities, knows how to evaluate their probability of purchasing different types of products. A more than 30% chance of buying cosmetics, costing more than 75 euros. More than 33% of dresses, costing more than 1,000 euros. And an over 40% chance of buying watches, costing more than 750 euros. This unprecedented qualitative rise in the analysis and tracing of activities can influence the purchasing power of more than 1.3 billion users who are offered individualized advertising. This capability attracts the biggest global brands and renders Facebook an internet giant. Beside the superiors of Silicon Valley, namely Apple, Google, and Amazon, known as GAFA, they establish a quartet with a market capitalization more than $1.5 trillion, a number larger than that of the four main international oil companies. And the data, which are the assets of these companies, are destined to grow exponentially through the online devices which are going to facilitate our lives and spy on all of our activities. This enormous amount of data, some billions per second, is sorted in what the internet operators call the cloud. Although this commercial name suggests that there is no material trace of our data, this cloud hides a physical storage as well. In a storage place, protected as a military base and inaccessible to journalists, all the data collected from the Google applications are copied, stored, and processed. Emails, photos, videos, browsing on the search engines. All our digital fingerprints are retained in these industrial buildings established in every corner of the world, and they're all interconnected.
One of the remarkable facts is that companies can easily know more about you than you know about yourself. I mean, consider Google, for example. It keeps your search history, everything you've been interested in for the last 5 years. I can't remember everything I was interested in for the last week. But if someone were to go to Google and say, well, what has this person been looking at, and what kinds of, you know, political beliefs do they have, and what are their goals, and what are their concerns? Google could likely answer that question for anybody more fully than any of us could about ourselves. And I think that's part of this reality, at least in the current day. I'd like to see that change. I'd like it to be the case that whatever a company knows about us, we would know as well.
Thus, we leave an ineffaceable mark of our actions, our travels, our opinions, and our desires. But what will happen if at some point we want to access this black box that archives our online lives? What will happen if we want to withdraw or modify the information that's about us? In Coronia, we met with the first citizen to bring an issue before the European court. Maria Costea Gonzalez is a graphologist in Coronia. In 1998, his apartment was auctioned off to cover his social security debts. So the legal notice was published in the regional newspaper La Vanguardia. In 2007, when the newspaper digitized its archives, Mario was automatically associated with this case on the first page of Google when he searched his name. Appealing for the right of privacy against a search engine that accounts for 97% of the searches in Europe seems to be a mission impossible. Maria Castella's petition could have shaken the Silicon Valley giant to the core. After 6 months of negotiations with Google, we could finally find a way to enter their campus and meet with David Drummond, their vice president in charge of legal affairs.
We have to strike a balance between privacy on the one hand, information on the other hand, innovation on the other hand. And so what's important is to make sure that we are protecting users' privacy, that users have choice and have transparency. So they know what is going on, they have the ability to change what's going on, and change settings, share the sharing of information is under their control. What we don't want to do is just ban things, ban the use of data, because data can be very important for society. And there are lots of innovations we can do that can move society forward, whether it's in the medical sphere and applying what so-called big data to important medical problems, and many other things. So we want to make sure that we have the freedom to innovate. But we should be clear that there are rules that involve user choice and transparency and the ability to change things.
In front of the giants of the internet, what is the scope of maneuvering in controlling their personal data for the citizens' consumers?
Seen from those internet giants, national rules are fragments, are nuisances, and that's very annoying. So there is a driving from this idea of individuals having to stay in control of their own data. There is a very fundamental question about democracy, the rule of law. Who is in control of values in a society?
A journey through the desert begins for Maria. Very few lawyers agree to be involved in what they already know is a lost case. He was turned down by some 20 lawyers before a young lawyer agreed to take on his case. Mr. Munaz, a specialist in new technologies, decided to speak out about what even the states didn't still dare put into question blatantly. The Spanish Agency for Data Protection, whose mission is to be watchful of citizen privacy, joined Mario's petition against Google. Maria Costea is the first citizen to bring an action before the European Court of Justice. Google played its best trumps against him. Francisco Diaz, former European Commissioner Mario Monti's right-hand man, became the lawyer of the large monopoly groups. He manages a group of about 10 lawyers. The Grand Inquisitor, a Spanish, defends Google in Brussels.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll discuss some of the contents of chapter Naml, the 27th chapter of the Holy Quran, as well as some of the commentary points of the verses. Brothers and sisters, let's listen to the 14th verse of Surah An-Naml.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَلَقَدْ آتَيْنَا دَاوُودَ وَسُلَيْمَانَ عِلْمًا وَقَالَ الْحَمْدُ لِلَّهِ الَّذِي فَضَّلَنَا عَلَى كَثِيرٍ مِّنْ عِبَادِهِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ
And we had certainly given to David and Solomon knowledge. And they said, Praise is due to Allah, who has favored us over many of his believing servants.
In the previous episodes, we mentioned that this great prophet of Allah, Prophet Moses, ala nabiyyina wa alihi wa alayhi salam, was granted with different kinds of powers and tools and miracles against people of Pharaoh. Why? The Holy Quran stated, innahu kanu qawman fasiqeen. They were a people pretty much transgressing. So against these transgressing people, one, specifically a prophet, needs to be at its full potentialities and powers. So, the Almighty Allah stated that we are giving you and granting you 9 different kinds of miracles. So, their answer regarding invitation of Prophet Moses to Almighty Allah, an absolute cause, regarding the introduction of prophethood, was that they denied. وَجَحَدُوا بِهَا وَاسْتَيْقَنَتْهَا أَنفُسُهُمْ ظُلْمًا وَعْلُوَّا As you listened in the beginning of this episode. They denied them unjustly and proudly. وَاسْتَيْقَنَتْهَا أَنفُسُهُمْ Though their hearts acknowledged them. In the previous episode, we mentioned that there might be different kinds of reasons for disbelief, different kinds of reasons for denial and infidelity. We mentioned all of them, and we said that the kind of infidelity we're discussing and dealing with in this verse is the kind that originates from actually what can be called a kind of enmity, a kind of arrogance. So they considered themselves better because of their own self-superiority, because of this complex. They did not want to accept the truth, though their hearts acknowledged it. وَاسْتَيْقَنَتْهَا أَنفُسُ So, when there is some people who want to believe in the truth, they will try to believe. They will bring some actually justifications, some arguments against you, and they will be guided if they find what you have provided them reasonable. But there are some other kinds of people that they bring accusations, they bring arguments against you, but they do not want to believe intentionally. This is because of their self-superiority.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine.
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So as we said, dear listeners, in the 14th verse of chapter Naml, there is one thing which is manifest. وَجَحَدُوا بِهَا وَاسْتَيْقَنَتْهَا أَنفُسُهُمْ ظُلْمًا وَعُلُوَّ. Why did these people deny the prophethood? Why was the prophethood denied? Why was the prophethood met with infidelity? Why? وَاسْتَيْقَنَتْهَا أَنفُسُهُمْ. Of course, they wanted to acknowledge by their hearts, but the reason is ظُلْمًا وَعُلُوَّ. Intentional injustice and عُلُوَّ. Self-superiority. Anyway, the verse continues saying, فَانْظُرْ كَيْفَ كَانَ عَاقِبَةُ الْمُفْسِدِينَ. Consider how was the end of the mischief makers. So, the Quran says that it is understood that faith has a reality besides knowledge and certainty. And blasphemy may exist because of denial and negation, while there is knowledge and awareness. وَاسْتَيْقَنَتْهَا أَنفُسُهُمْ. The verses. And this is really important. Some people can be misled, although their hearts might want to accept the truth. In other words, the reality of the correct faith is an outward and inward submission before the truth. So, let me explain this. That if a person is certain of something, but he does not surrender to it inwardly or outwardly, he has not faith, but he is a disbeliever of the denial kind. This is what we're talking about here. This is a vast matter that now we suffice only to this actually short kind of explanation and elaboration here. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, in a tradition explaining five kinds of disbelief, counts one of them, this kind of disbelief, and that one of its branches is denial. He says, that is something that one denies while he knows that it is surely the truth which has been proved with him. Then he recites this verse of the Holy Quran, this verse that we are discussing in this episode. Anyway, this is the importance